You are listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. Folks, you have no idea what you're missing. It's 2020. You need to be as informed as possible, not just going into this primary season, but going into what could be a very nutso general election. And frankly, regardless of who wins, a nutso following months following that election. Head over to ROFpodcast.com. You can support the show by becoming a member. You get the show commercial free. You get extra material than what you're going to hear on this free version of the show. And you get access to our archives of over 10 years. And you make sure this show continues to exist. So if you enjoy this show, help us out. Head over to ROFpodcast.com. Sign up to become a member. I can assure you, you'll be happy you did. In the meantime, enjoy the show. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Alex Horton from the Washington Post will be here to discuss Russian operatives targeting veterans groups through social media to lead a massive misinformation campaign and a Trump administration that's doing nothing about it. Kentucky Progressive Senate candidate Charles Booker will join us to discuss his challenge to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Heather Digby Parton will be here to run down all the biggest news of this past week. And we'll listen to my interview with Jamal Abdi, president of the National Iranian American Council, about the recent drone strike in Iraq that killed Iranian Major General Qasem Soleimani and the Iraqi military commander Abu Mahdi Mohandas. If you're listening to the radio right now, you should know that there's a free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are found. There's also a member show. You can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show commercial-free with access to 10 years of our archives. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Help me bring in the first show of the new year, Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, this week, obviously, is really, and it's our first time back, I guess, now that it occurs to me. Feels like we've been back forever. And really, in many respects, this week started for us on a Friday when Donald Trump ordered the assassination of a general, an Iranian general, who was the commander of the Quds Force and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, was also, I guess, a regional manager, if you will, of militias around in the Middle East that fight as proxies for Iran. And then it was just several days of waiting to see how Iran would react, whether and we'll talk about this, but let's just get some of the facts on the table. Iran on Tuesday evening fired about a dozen or so ballistic missiles into a couple of bases in Iraq, killing no one, basically landing in essentially abandoned spaces in these bases. I mean, not terribly dissimilar to our attack on Syria, where we just blew up an incidental building and an airfield type of situation. And there we have it. And, World War III averted. Thank goodness for Donald Trump.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. since he's the one who precipitated the whole thing. And, I mean, let's be clear about how this has come about. I mean, obviously, going all the way back to the 1950s, if you want to go back that far to the installation of the Shah by the United States, up through 1979 with the deposing of the Shah by the Ayatollahs and the Iran Revolution, up through all that's happened since then until now, I mean, this has been going on, this back and forth with Iran has been going on for a very, very long time. Getting that out of the way, in recent years, what we had under the Obama administration and a whole bunch of other people who signed on to it was an agreement to try to stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. And it was a huge undertaking to get that far. They, for obvious reasons, Iran is, you know, paranoid, and they see themselves as being under siege, which they are, as are others in the region. I mean, it's a volatile region where they're all at each other's throats for very variety of reasons, some of it based on religion, obviously. So they, you know, agreed to give up their nuclear program, and by to all intents and purposes, they were doing that. Now, what that didn't mean was that they were going to give up a lot of the other things that they were doing, which was they have all these proxies in various countries that, you know, do terrorism and that are, you know, interfering in a variety of different, you know, political, religious, and otherwise, you know, other regional sort of conflicts. But everybody knew that. The nuclear deal was just very, very specifically focused on the idea of getting them to, and, you know, it's an advanced country, so they will be able to, if they can get the materials, make a nuclear weapon or several. I mean, they have, you know, high-tech capabilities. So, you know, when Trump came in, he, like the rest of these hardliners, you know, decided, in Trump's case, it's purely because he wanted to reverse anything that Obama did. The rest of these hardliners have just, it is not good enough for them to stop the nuclear program by Iran or anything else. They really and truly are committed to regime change, meaning they want to depose the Ayatollahs. In other words, go back and do what we did in the 1950s. It wasn't the Ayatollahs that were deposed, but whatever. They want to interfere on that level and change the government of Iran from the outside. And I get the feeling that they really just want to do that, that it's not really a matter of what the outcome is. They want to be the instrument that does that. They have a great, they're just as vengeful in their way as they claim the Iranians are. So, you know, essentially when Trump came in and because he wanted to reverse it, you know, they kind of held him back for the first year. But when Mike Pompeo came in, they got rid of Jim Mattis. You know, they were able to persuade him that, you know, now's the time, and he withdrew from the deal, and that escalated and imposed a bunch of very, very harsh sanctions as well, which had been, you know, they had been lifted through the Iran nuclear deal, giving the Iranians a chance. And by the way, what that also did was sort of revive the, you know, the sort of revolutionary political zeal among the people. And there was a lot of resistance that was growing to the Ayatollahs and the system as it is. So that part was working. By lifting sanctions, they were sort of giving people a sort of sense that they were not under siege. Well, Trump changed all that, of course,
right.
And we're right back where we started, and we're worse off than we were before, by far. And now we are on the brink of war.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many aspects to this that are incredibly troubling. And even if, you know, at this stage, I mean, look, the Iranians retaliated. I suspect that is just simply their first retaliation. Yeah. And at the very least, maybe their, you know, if we're lucky, their only public one. You know, as I was talking to people, we recorded an interview that playing on this show, recorded over the, you know, right at the beginning of this crisis. And really the question was, could the Iranians retaliate in such a way that satisfied their constituency? Because, you know, this is Soleimani was, you know, an incredibly popular general in Iran. I mean, you know, the only thing that I think we could talk about that we had sort of like close to that in this country in the past 25 years was Colin Powell before he got caught up in selling,
right,
George Bush's war. And even then, I don't know if it would have been as as dramatic. But Soleimani was very popular in Iran. Could the Iranians find something that they could do that would satisfy that constituency, but at the same time not impact the sensibility of the American people enough to justify or to make it obvious that Donald Trump could justify an attack on Iran? And that they seem to have at this point threaded that needle. But when we come back, I want to talk about, even if that's all that happened, the horror show that this revealed, both in terms of like our media, both in terms of our Congress, the Republican Party, the administration, and I would argue, just sort of like, broadly speaking, generic leaders of generic countries, all of that. I think this has been incredibly, you know, and hopefully not any more damaging and life-threatening for you know, people across the region, you know, event. But it has been certainly an illuminating one as well. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with the great Digby. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Digby. So, Heather, we're obviously talking about the situation with Iran, and you made the point in the last segment that this was all, and I want to be careful to say that it was inevitable, but it certainly was a predictable, and it certainly looks like it was not just predictable, but also a, you know, there was an agenda here. And when Donald Trump, you know, for his reasons, essentially walked away from the Iranian nuclear deal and reinstated some sanctions against the Iranians, if someone told me, I have a computer readout of Donald Trump's brain, and it was all because it was Barack Obama's deal and he hated Barack Obama and wanted to make himself feel better. Now, of course, he's surrounded, like you say, by, and I don't, I mean, you tell me, do you think there's anything left of what we used to call the Republican foreign policy establishment? I mean, it seems to me, to the extent that they exist, they're just sort of, you know, like establishment Democratic foreign policy, like there's some type of realism. It seems to me the Republican Party, they tried to sell this idea that they had purged themselves of the neocons. I don't know that there's anything but neocons, inspired at least in part by a theocracy or a theocratic zeal, let's put it that way. I mean, what's your take on that, Digby?
Absolutely. I agree with you completely. I think, what is left of the Republican foreign policy establishment, I think we can, basically all you have to do is look at Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, to see what that is, because he embodies it. He is a Trumpist, of course. You know, he is fine with Donald Trump. He didn't start off that way. He was a Marco Rubio guy, another one who has become a Trumpist. These people have, absolutely no problem going along with Donald Trump's impulsive and erratic decision making. Their focus, and even on the neoconservative level, they've kind of shrunk in terms of what they really care about and what Pompeo really cares about. He is truly focused and actually fanatical in his desire to confront Iran. I mean, this moves him more than anything else. He doesn't care much about Russia, the China thing, he's sort of mildly interested in. I mean, from what I'm reading about him, there's been a few profiles of him, one in the New Yorker by Susan Glasser that's just great, and everybody should go read it if they can. And the New York Times has done a lot of work on Pompeo, too, but I don't think it really penetrated just what a fanatical weirdo this guy really is. And yet, he is the establishment. He represents that neoconservative strain that you mentioned, which is, still, I don't know why anybody thought they had, just because some of the never-Trumpers were conservatives, neoconservatives, doesn't mean there are no neoconservatives still in the Republican establishment. There are plenty of them. And the influence that the neoconservatives had over the Republican Party is lasting. It is as clear as day. I mean, Dick Cheney didn't start out as a neoconservative either, but he became one and became one of the leaders of neoconservatism. So that part is still there. Then there's this, as you mentioned, this theocratic side. A lot of this is very scary. Mike Pompeo is a very, very fervent evangelical Christian, and he's gone all over the world quoting Bible verses. He says that Donald Trump is Queen Esther. A lot of what he's doing has to do with that Israel, situation that the evangelical Christians are. And some of that's political. He's trying to keep them in the fold, of course, and there have been some rifts in there. But as far as the Israel thing is concerned, for evangelical Christians, that confrontation with Iran is absolutely, I mean, they're excited about it. It means that they could be on the verge of the rapture. Mike Pompeo has made speeches about the rapture and saying, let's get in the fight. I mean, he literally said that. So, you have this combination of things that now has become the Republican foreign policy, and I see no, absolutely zero evidence that anybody is fighting against that within the Republican Party. None.
Yeah.
I don't see any. I mean, even a Mitt Romney or somebody who you think of as sort of a standard issue, old school Republican, has he said anything about this? I mean, nothing. So I don't, he's kind of, whatever. Let's see the evidence. And of course, they went in and showed the evidence. The Democrats came out calling it a childish,
sophomoric, I think was the words.
Sophomoric.
And yeah, I mean, it really is stunning. And obviously I want to talk more about this. I want to talk about how the media has reacted to this in many respects. I mean, what I saw this week was horrifying in many respects, because of the experience. I know you went through the same thing in the run up to the Iraq War. But the way in which the Republicans sort of massed around this, and the neocons who built this, and like I say, Donald Trump, I don't think has a single geopolitical thought in his mind that isn't either a function of what he thinks he can gain out of it or knows he can gain out of it, both politically and probably, personally, materially, type of thing. But in the next hour, let's come back and talk a little bit about what we saw with the media, and of course the insanity of it all, and the complete pointlessness of it all, really struck me hard this week. And then we've also got a lot to talk about in terms of 2020. I will be right back with Ring of Fire Radio. Digby will join me in the next hour. I'm Sam Cedar. Right back after this. Coming up, we'll discuss the political strategy that led to the drone strike in Iraq last week. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, Sam Cedar here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like the Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a five-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick, and we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. During our holiday break, news broke of a U.S. drone strike in Iraq that led to the death of Qasem Soleimani, a major general in the Iranian army, and an Iraqi militia commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Shortly after the news broke, I spoke to the president of the National Iranian American Council, Jamal Abdi, about the political strategy behind the attacks. Let's listen in now. Jamal, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Let's just, I imagine by now that people are familiar with the two most, I guess, prominent men who were assassinated by the U.S., killed in a drone strike. But tell us something about Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis.
Well, I think the real implications of this strike, lie with the Soleimani assassination. Muhandis having a role, you know, as an official with the PMF is significant because this seems to be yet another violation of Iraqi sovereignty and a sign that the United States is doubling down on the strikes that took place, which triggered the demonstration and attack on the embassy and triggered backlash among the Iraqi parliament and government. With Soleimani, though, this is this is a world historic event, I think. I mean, this is the most influential general inside of Iran, and really potentially, you know, the second most powerful man inside of the country. He was responsible for Iran's posture in the region and coordinating these proxy and militia groups that Iran really relied on as part of its security strategy to fight this asymmetric battle against really, you know, the U.S. and its allies. And Soleimani actually has a pretty mixed record inside of Iran among Iranians, but actually according to polling, had a favorability of 80% among Iranians, making him the most popular public official inside of Iran. And I think that is because, you know, this is a hardliner, somebody who was very much part of Iran's repressive domestic apparatus, but he was viewed as somebody who really was a protector of Iran. He is viewed as the person who probably had the greatest role in defeating ISIS and from preventing Iran from becoming the, you know, what a lot of the states neighboring Iran have become, these war zones and these failed states. And so a lot of Iranians, you know, even if they had negative views of the Iranian government and the regime and the hardliners and things like that, Soleimani still, I think, had a respect because of his ability to actually protect the territorial integrity of Iran and prevent these bad things from happening inside the country.
I mean, in the final analysis, and I've spoken to other people who've suggested that he had less, because he was less prominent in the domestic repression, that helped his favorability ratings. But I guess the bottom line is, if 80% of the people in Iran saw this guy favorably, and I've seen some, I think, well-known reformers, members of parliament, tweet out condolences, to the extent that is heartfelt or not. The bottom line is that it's seen, it creates the political pressure domestically in Iran, and maybe gives the opportunity for Iran to retaliate. I want to get there in a bit, but first, let me just ask you this, and I've asked this question of other people, and I obviously there's no way for you to know for sure, but the reason why I bring up Mohandas is, and who is an Iraqi, and obviously it represents another intrusion upon Iraqi sovereignty, but Mohandas was more associated with the incursion into the U.S. embassy, and I wonder if, despite the fact that the U.S. essentially claimed credit for targeting Soleimani, if you think that this was a mistake in some way, or if this was like the intention, it was just a very weird way, you know, even from the logic of the Trump administration, to the extent that there is any, it's a weird way of approaching this. I mean, Soleimani was not a household name in the United States. They are now talking about him like he was public enemy number one. And even on Fox News, I don't think that his name got mentioned more than, you know, two times in the past year and a half or something. This is an odd way to go about this from the Trump administration perspective, unless from your perspective, it has a real operational difference on the ground.
I don't think it has an operational difference. I think the difference that this makes, though, you may be right, and we're all kind of grasping at straws, trying to assign some logic to the way, I mean, in many cases, in the way that this administration behaves and operates, you know. And, I mean, I wondered, and I still wonder, did Donald Trump move from a position where he was actually fairly conservative when it came to kinetic, you know, the use of military force against Iran? You know, he famously pulled back from bombing Iran with just 10 minutes to go because he realized it was disproportionate and it could trigger a Iranian retaliation that would lead to an all-out war. So why did he suddenly cross the threshold and is now greenlighting this, highly disproportionate and this action that will very likely lead to Iranian retaliation? What has changed? I wondered if it was because the supreme leader of Iran actually tweeted and insulted Trump on Twitter and claimed that he couldn't do anything and kind of challenged his manhood, if Trump felt like he needed to respond to that and this was an ego move. I mean, you can't rule anything out.
Right.
But you know, I will say, while I don't think Soleimani changes things operationally, I mean, supposedly he's this military genius and all these great things, but I'm sure that that role can be replaced, you know, to some level. But this does almost certainly put the U.S. and Iran on a path to conflict. It makes the prospect of the thing that groups like, you know, Foundation for Defense of Democracies and people like, you know, John Bolton, who, you know, probably wishes he was back in the White House to be celebrating right now. But what they feared most was Donald Trump getting into the same room as Rouhani or Zarif and striking a deal with these guys. And I think that 2020 was viewed and is viewed by a lot of the folks who for the past two decades, even more than that, have wanted to go to war with Iran or who have wanted to at least destabilize and topple the regime in Iran, that 2020 was their last best hope to do that while they still had Donald Trump in the White House, falling for their traps. And this now, I don't see a pathway, at least for Donald Trump, to get to the table with Iran. That is just not going to happen. We are now on the course to war if we're not already there yet. And so my sense is that there was a lot of pressure on Donald Trump to take this action. You know, there were incremental steps towards this. You know, the U.S., after years of the Pentagon pushing back on the proposal to designate the Revolutionary Guard Corps as a foreign terrorist organization, an unprecedented step, you know, designating a state's military as a terrorist organization. After years of pushback under the Bush administration, the Obama administration, Trump finally greenlit it and designated the group as a terrorist organization. After that happened, calls started to come from the, you know, the neocon think tanks in Washington, and even Mike Pompeo himself inferred or acknowledged that, yes, we would potentially target Soleimani because he's a terrorist and we would treat him like al-Baghdadi of ISIS. So this is, while this came as a surprise, and I think nobody thought that the United States and the Trump administration would be would have the gall to actually go forward with this and deal with the implications, it doesn't come out of nowhere. There was a campaign behind this.
So, Jamal, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll discuss this major escalation, it seems, that may have us on the brink of a war with Iran. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, Sam Cedar here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like the Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a five-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick, and we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, we are airing my interview with Jamal Abdi from the National Iranian American Council about the recent drone strike in Iraq. It killed the Iranian Major General Qasem Soleimani and an Iraqi militia commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. When we sat down to record this interview, news of a counterattack by the Iranian military had not yet taken place. Let's listen in. We've discussed this sort of the possible rationales for this, and obviously these possible rationales on this assassination of Soleimani could range from, I guess, you know, I don't know why Donald Trump would have an agenda of this sorts. I mean, of a guy he didn't even know who existed really 2 or 3 years prior, and there's clearly people who don't want a deal to be made. It's not clear to me that Donald Trump didn't want to make a deal, but again, it's very hard to get into his head. So let's try something that is equally as challenging. Having established that might be hard. What are the pressures on the Iranian leadership now, and what might they do to retaliate? Because this seems to me to be like this is the way that it would go, right? They're going to retaliate, and the question is the nature of the retaliation, how the U.S. reacts to that retaliation is a function of what the retaliation is, and I guess how much the U.S. feels, the Trump administration feels they need to escalate or to maintain their I guess, manhood, their dominance. I mean, honestly, I mean, there's a quality of this. It feels like, you know, some middle-aged guy getting a Corvette. But there was one thing I saw earlier today was the spokesman for the Iranian Parliament's Committee on National Security put out this statement, quote, "Vengeance for the assassination of General Soleimani does not require a regional war, and the United States will pay a heavy price for committing this crime." Well, I mean, give me a sense of what that means, if it means anything, you know, that is from which we can divine what the Iranians might do to respond, and what is on the table in terms of their response, do you think?
So there's certainly the possibility of attacks on U.S. service members, on interests and assets of, you know, U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia and Israel, if there is sort of another gear towards the Iranian escalation, which I think there certainly is. I think Iran has been relatively restrained in how it has responded to the maximum pressure campaign. Iran took some pretty provocative moves, such as targeting the Saudi oil facility, but always with plausible deniability and always sort of with a mind of, you know, not allowing this to cross a line that could trigger a escalation towards war. And I think that now the, you know, the leash has been taken off. Now, you know, we'll see how sort of strategic the Iranians want to be about this, or if there's, you know, if sort of the more aggressive hardline forces in Iran have enough say that they actually encourage, you know, outright encouragement of attacks on U.S. personnel or otherwise. So that's certainly, you know, I think the first thing that people will point to. And then, you know,
let me just stop you there for a second. Just will you explain the dynamic of like what you know, and I think this may be more of a generic statecraft question, but the value of deniability or plausible deniability, at least. I mean, the U.S. could have said we were targeting Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was this Iraqi militia leader, and we got lucky in also assassinating Soleimani, and given some wiggle room that, you know, the U.S. did not actually target this very popular military figure in Iran. That was almost sort of accidental, and that would have put less pressure on the Iranians, correct? I mean, expand on that dynamic, like how that works also for the Iranians. Like, what's the point there of that?
Yeah, well, that certainly wouldn't be very manly if that's what Donald Trump went out and said publicly. I think there's a little bit of a ego issue there. But this has actually been pointed out with the strikes by the U.S. That triggered the embassy protests. And the fact that, you know, some analysts said Israel has been striking these Iran-linked militias for some time, but not talking about it publicly and providing Iran a face-saving way to not retaliate so that Israel could, and, you know, I don't want to necessarily celebrate that whole situation, but that's the thinking there, that Israel was able to sort of project this military power, but not invite a full-scale escalation. And the U.S., you know, I think that the issue here is that the folks who are making these decisions really do believe in, you know, peace through strength. And, you know, the only thing the Iranians understand is force. And, you know, you got to punch them in the mouth and then brag about it in order to cow them from retaliating. And just kind of continually failing to understand that that doesn't work, especially not with Iran. Iran, you know, is going to retaliate. This is a government that is being squeezed right now. It does not have a lot to lose, but one of the key things that it could lose is if there's a sense that it is surrendering to the United States, and, you know, I think that would be very bad for the government. But so this plausible deniability, you know, such as with the strike on the Saudi oil facility, that really is, you know, that's cover to not allow this to escalate out of control. And for the United States, you know, Pompeo and others claim that they had evidence that Iran launched those strikes, but nobody ever really saw the evidence, didn't really add up. And so there wasn't a lot of basis for a reprisal, at least not a public one. Now, apparently the U.S. did, you know, launch some cyber attacks inside of Iran, and that did get leaked, but I don't think it was necessarily something that they bragged about. And so it didn't necessarily trigger a retaliation.
Well, I mean, so now we have this situation where, like, I don't understand, like, what the Trump administration thinks they can get out of this, because, like I say, most people did not know that this was a public enemy number one, Soleimani. Nobody had heard the guy's name. You know, obviously you had, and I had in passing, but for people who, you know, your average American certainly has not been, there's been no build up to this. It seems to me that, a retaliation at this point is going to look like the first volley. I don't even think that most of the American public had been aware of what happened in Baghdad in terms of the embassy. So where does this go? Are we just simply waiting now to see the size or the nature of the retaliation? And if it's one that the Iranians can basically satiate their domestic, I guess, appetite, and at the same time, not force the hand of you know, a very fragile ego in Donald Trump?
Well, the entire Trump-Iran strategy, if you can call it that, there was no real end goal. You know, there was Iran was being sanctioned, even though it has been upholding its commitments under the nuclear deal. So it's getting punished for keeping to its word. And the rationale was supposedly, you know, the U.S. is going to beat up Iran so bad that Iran's going to come to the negotiating table hat in hand to give the U.S. whatever they wanted, right up to the brink of just changing the entire regime. I don't think anybody seriously believed that that was a possibility. So this has always been kind of a dead-end strategy. I think, you know, I don't know that the U.S. has prepared for what's next. I don't know if there's an idea of what to do other than just maximum pressure, just turn the screws as much as possible on Iran. And I think to some extent the Trump administration kind of believes its own propaganda that, you know, Iran, the government's on the brink of collapse and that there's, you know, the possibility of a failed state, you know, an imminent failed state there, and something like this could actually, you know, assassinating Soleimani was actually something that a Saudi general actually proposed to an intermediary with the Trump transition team as part of a plan to destabilize Iran and destabilize the regime. So this has been something that has been discussed in the past. But for Iran, you know, I guess it's a wait-and-see approach for the United States, but Iran has other areas where it could escalate. I mean, on one hand, Iran still, to some extent, has the buy-in of the international community and of Europe when it comes to the nuclear deal. You know, everybody's trying to save this deal other than the United States. So they're going to ratchet up their nuclear program. They already had plans to take some steps on January 6th to do that, and they may take it to a level that had previously not been foreseen that could really pose the threat of them becoming a, you know, undetectable nuclear weapons state or something along those lines. Or they could, you know, try to work the international community to try to get some resolution through, you know, internationally sanctioned means, although I think that that's probably a pretty remote possibility. But yeah, I think we're all waiting and seeing, and that includes the Trump administration.
Jamal Abdi, President, National Iranian American Council, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Sam.
When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show. Hey, folks. It's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.